Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com. Hello and welcome to episode 100 of Enterprise Linux Security. After a long and tedious move to South Carolina that's actually kind of still in progress, you could kind of tell because I don't have my camera. If you're watching this, you're not seeing me, you're seeing Zhao. I have a microphone working so far in the studio, but anyway, it's just the way it is. We have the show must go on with or without the camera on my end. So that's kind of the situation. So we have three stories to talk about today, and one of which is kind of like something we've been talking about. Actually, a couple of these things are something we've been talking about for a while. We've been talking about backdoors and why they're bad when it comes to crypto. We have an example in this episode of, you know, basically we were saying this is going to happen and it happened. You'll find out what I'm talking about. And of course, we talk about the cost of switching, and we have, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't this like the most expensive story of an IT migration that we've covered yet?
Yeah, the ones that we've covered, absolutely. For sure it is.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the cost of migrating, and we've talked about this many times before, especially with the CentOS and Red Hat switcheroos that have happened. I'm not going to get into that again, but we have an even more egregious one that we'll talk about. And we're also going to talk about missing log files. So it's going to be a really fun episode.
Yeah. So let's get this out of the way. Hi, Jay. Pleasure being here with you. Finally, episode 100. We've been slowly inching towards it for the past few years. It's amazing. First thing here. I know you have other shows that you've done longer than this, but yeah, I'm not really used to doing that, so it's amazing reaching this mark.
I'm sorry.
No, go on.
I was just going to say, it's amazing to me too, because it's funny, you know, we could talk a little bit about this. I think this is probably a good thing to talk about, the little history. Enterprise Linux Security started as a normal YouTube series, non-podcast, just it was going to be kind of like, oh, I'm just going to talk about security. It wasn't really the greatest of ideas on my part, but, you know, Sasha introduced me to you and like, this could be a podcast. I'm like, you know what? That would work. Whereas the normal YouTube series would not work for this, a podcast would absolutely work. And this has become, I mean, easily one of my, if not favorite things right now, because I just love the fact that we could, you know, cover these things from the Linux perspective, but also give our, you know, industry experience, our, you know, get off our lawn experience when it comes to these kinds of things. And it's been, you know, 100 episodes, it's amazing. And I feel bad that it took this long to get here. The move to South Carolina, moving a house and a studio at the same time, and also attending All Things Open during this as well, was quite a ride. But we had to get this going. It's like, I have no camera. I don't have my camera set up, but I want to do this podcast. I can't wait to do this podcast. So definitely wanted to make sure this happened. And from here on out, you know, maybe next time we'll have the camera set up. So, you know, it sucks to not have that set up, but I just really love the reach of the podcast, the response that it's getting. It's just been amazing for me as well. So thanks to everybody that, you know, sticks with us and, you know, looks forward to hearing what we have to say about all this security shenanigans that happen. And I love and appreciate every single one of you. And thank you for helping us make this successful.
Thank you very much, guys. So let's dive into this. We'll be looking at policy and business decisions. We'll be looking at how everything is actually about security in the end. We'll be covering, as you mentioned, logs are the Tarapate feature right now, which completely blows your mind if you think about it for a second about it.
In Azure.
How backdoors are not just for you ever, and if you built it, somebody else is also going to use it. And how a business decision, like you mentioned, can quickly turn into a security problem. It's both very expensive and a very risky proposition.
Right.
So let's take it from the top. The first story is about something that came out during these weeks that we haven't been in the air. There's a story about Microsoft that broke that apparently, and again, the details on this are amazing. So it looks, it seems that a few of the security products that Microsoft uses on Azure, like Sentinel, like Defender, like other tools that they have, they lost the logs for that. For a period of about 2 weeks, there are no logs. They did an update internally to one of their tools, apparently, and they lost the logs for that period. Coming out of that, which is already in itself amazing, how you update something and you break your logging system, which, by the way, absolutely reminds you of CrowdStrike. How yes. did they not test this properly before putting it into production is beyond me. But apparently they did. So yeah, they deployed an update internally, it broke their logging facility, and customers lost over 2 weeks of logging. And like I said, it's not just any old log, it's not just your access log for your HTTP server, it's the log for their security features, for their security products, which incidentally are also the ones that you look at when you're trying to solve some security problem. Man, this really, really paints a great picture at Microsoft focusing on security like they promised a couple of months back, and coming hot in the heels of that hack where somebody else was looking at their CEO's email for a while. They really stepped up their security game.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really awkward conversation, I can imagine, where, you know, your boss is like, hey, we have an issue. We need to look into the logs. There might be a security issue. Oh, yeah, about that. We don't have any logs to look at. And that's not good. I mean, just like the article that's linked, it will be in the show notes. It's not now, but it will be. It talks about this, that, you know, this is a situation where, you know, it's one thing, compliance, you could have compliance penalties, but the security penalty is that you don't really have the visibility you need to know what's going on as a tenant in Azure. And, you know, as an admin, obviously you need to know these things. You need to keep an eye on things, but you can't keep an eye on things when the information just isn't there.
And the cherry on top of that story about losing the logs is that apparently logging is a paid feature. So you don't get any logs at all as a standard user from those security tools that they have. You only get the access to the logs if you pay a higher tier of your subscription to Azure. Mm-hmm. And again, logging is like basic stuff. What's next? They're going to prevent you from hitting the E key or something like that? You can't press E unless you pay a higher subscription?
I mean, I'm already thinking that at some point they're going to disable the mute buttons on our phones or the volume slider on our phones when we're watching an ad. I'm telling you right now the way things are going. But back to this, I mean, it's just, I mean, we have the like you mentioned, the issue already that Microsoft had recently trying to step up security. Yeah, to be fair, hackers can't steal logs that aren't there. but I don't think that's the security that they were going for, or at least should have been going for. We need this information. And we were talking about this off camera before we hit the record button. I'm not really the most advanced Azure person ever. I mean, I'm familiar with it. I've used it. But, you know, I'm not as knowledgeable. So at first I'm thinking, well, now people are just going to have to stand up a Graylog server and maybe avoid paying for the logging altogether. But as we were discussing, it's not that simple because these are the built-in service logs for Azure itself. I mean, that's not even at Graylog's level. I mean, you could grab your Linux log, sure, but you're not going to have like access information and things like that, you know, you really do need to have. And then when I discovered that logging was a paid feature, I was like, did I read this right? Like actually they're putting this on, I think I read they're putting it on standard accounts. It wasn't there now, or as of right now. That was surprising, very surprising.
I mean, if you want to be concerned about security, if you want to focus all your efforts on security, if you want to improve your game, at the very least, providing the logs that people need to look at when they're using your services, that's basic stuff. But yeah, as you were saying, the reason why you can't simply spin a Graylog and aggregate all the logs is that these aren't the logs from the stuff that you upload there. These are the logs from their security stuff. These are the logs from the IDS solution. These are the logs from the antivirus solution. These are the logs from the firewall. From the firewall at the provider level, not at the individual host, at the individual server level. So to get to those logs, you need to pay a higher subscription.
And yeah.
thinking about that for a second, and that in the same sentence saying that you're concerned about security, I mean, it makes no sense at all.
And it might even be illegal. I mean, you have in some areas requirements on retention. You have to keep data for a certain amount of time to be in compliance. I mean, I can only imagine somebody trying to do a SOC 2 audit or a renew or something, and then they fail the audit because Microsoft doesn't have the logs at no fault of the admin, him or herself.
They probably just got jealous of some private internet providers, some VPN providers that flaunt that they store no logs at all, and Microsoft said that they wanted to unup them.
Oh my gosh. that's terrible. So I think that one of the main things here is that the whole point of cloud, at least to me, is you know, you save money by not having to worry about the power bill and, you know, obsolescence of the hardware, replacing the hardware when it, you know, every certain number of years you're a tenant in someone else's platform. The least we want, the very minimum that we want, is for these things to work to where we don't have to ask the question, you know, why are we putting things in the cloud when at the end of the day we don't really know what's going to be there tomorrow?
I mean, you trade off control for the ease of not having to worry about the things that you said.
Yeah.
But at some point, having that level of control is also necessary and is also advantageous. It might not be in every situation, but...
Yeah.
The problem is that when you actually need it, you won't have it, which is a problem. But you probably won't think about it 99% of the time. So, yeah.
It's not really something we think about, like, by default. I mean, we look at the white papers or the spec sheet or whatever it is. We choose a cloud platform, and we just have this peace of mind, and or at least we think we do, where, oh, they're taking care of it for us. I don't have to worry about that. And we're finding out that we really do need to, you know, be behind our cloud provider checking to make sure that the things that are being done are actually being done. Logging is happening. Our VMs aren't, you know, getting wiped, which we've had that happen. This podcast, we've talked about, you know, people that have woke up one morning and decided or found out that their infrastructure is gone. And these are the very things that just can't happen when we are relying on someone else to host our technology.
And we'll probably touch back on some of these points in the final story because, yeah, we'll have something to say about that as well in the last story. So keep up if you're interested about more information on the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we can move to the next one.
I think so.
Okay, so... yeah, there's this nice article by Cory Doctorow. He writes very well,
mm-hmm.
And he did again. And apparently there's this story about some Chinese-sponsored hacker group or threat group or whatever you want to call it that got into AT&T and Verizon and Lumen, and apparently they didn't even have to hack anything. I mean, it's not really hacking if you're just going through the door, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the way that this happened is that this threat group got access through a backdoor that telecom providers have to have built in. And they have to have that backdoor because law enforcement might need access when they need to eavesdrop on somebody's communications. And the funny thing here is that this stems from a law that was passed in 1995 under Bill Clinton, or 1994, I can't recall exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called the Kalea Act. And telecom providers are mandated by law to provide access to law enforcement whenever that's required. And the thing is, they have to design all of their architecture and their infrastructure in such a way that when law enforcement requires that access, it can't be very difficult to get to. So they have to have access points made available. They have to have points where they can just snoop the traffic and look for what they want and not have to jump through all of the hoops to do that.
Right.
So when you think about that for a second and you think about how you create the architecture for a new service or for a new deployment that you're creating or something like that, you have security in mind, you always try to avoid leaving any open doors for anybody else to exploit. So you try to design with security in mind. This law, in fact, forces you to do the absolutely exactly opposite. You need to design with the flaw in mind. You need to build the flaw into the system.
Yeah.
And guess what? when you design a backdoor, it's never just for you. It's always a bad idea to have a backdoor, because as soon as somebody knows that it's there, that's where they're trying to get into, and that's how they do it, and they succeeded again.
Yeah, I mean, we have to keep in mind, there's no honor among thieves. I mean, it's not even just the math. The article mentions something called nerd harder, as if to say, like, you know, someone, you know, we say the math doesn't work that way, and then they think, well, these people make crazy awesome things happen with technology. There's no reason why we can't have a back door, and then the tech people can't figure this out and make it work. They kind of float us as having superpowers. We don't. We just know our job, and it's not even just about the math. I mean, if it was a physical skeleton key that a police officer had, and it, you know, he or she drops it, and then a thief isn't going to say, well, I shouldn't use it, it's just not right. No, if there's a way in, then, and someone that wants in has access to it, that's exactly what they're going to use. And the threat actors are smart. They're not going to do unnecessary work. They're not going to churn for hours and hours and hours trying to break into something that has a back door. If they know there's a back door, I guarantee you that's the very first thing they're going to try, because that's the path of least resistance. And that's exactly what this law provides, as a path of least resistance to threat actors. And we've been saying for time and time again, you know, why this is bad, why we can't have this. It's one thing to just say that, but it's another thing. Today we have an example, okay? This is exactly the situation that we've been talking about probably for the life of this entire podcast, and now we have a situation where we have eavesdropping as a service.
Corey, actually, because when you build that type of things, when you create this type of laws, you create a ripple effect on the market. The US market for telecommunications is so huge, and Corey points this out as well in his article. The telecom market is so huge that when you create a law like this, the vendors are going to start having the backdoor built into the devices that they create and that they sell to the telecom providers. So what happens is that they're going to purchase equipment that comes with the backdoor in the firmware straight from the factory. And the ripple effect here is that when other countries try to purchase the same equipment, they won't get a different version of the equipment. Because the US market is so large, they're not going to create two versions of the equipment, one with the backdoor and another without it. So in 2004, the Greek government was spied upon by the US using the backdoor that they had on their telecom devices, the same backdoor that was forced into the devices, and the Greeks were using them on their telecom providers, and this went up to the spying the prime minister of Greece. And the goal here for the ones doing the spying, and incidentally it was the US, was to mess up with their bid for the Olympics. So it wasn't even a life or death situation. They simply wanted to see what the Greeks were doing on their Olympics bid, and they'd used the backdoor that they had on the networking equipment. And it's crazy that when you have a backdoor that's supposed to be used just for law enforcement, and then as an unintended consequence, it gets spread all over the world, it's going to be abused for other reasons by the same ones that forced the backdoor in the first place. So this isn't something that's just restricted to the US. This is something that reaches worldwide. And again, when you build the backdoor and stuff, and this ties into something that we talked a few episodes back, where the EU was going to vote on a law about forcing a backdoor on encryption, which essentially is exactly the same thing. And it was actually pulled from the vote because they didn't get the support at the time. But the idea to break encryption, to have access to communications and communications equipment in a way that's going to be used just for law enforcement, it's a pipe dream. It's never just going to be for law enforcement. It's going to be for everybody that knows about it. And the first minute that you have a law enforcement officer that gets discharged from duty and sells the information to somebody else, then you have a big problem into your hands, even if it's kept under wraps and you try to keep it as secure as possible. That's never going to work. like he says in the article, mass doesn't work that way. You can't create a backdoor just for you. If it's there, it's going to be discovered. And if it's going to be discovered, it's going to be abused. And then it's going to be abused for the most trivial stuff that you can think of.
Mm-hmm. And this is just going to be the first story of this. I can easily predict we at some point in the podcast have another story of a company that has had access unauthorized due to this. You know, call me old-fashioned, I prefer law enforcement having to do actual work and getting a subpoena to get access to things. This little fast, we need access now, we need, you know, permanent access to everything is just going to, you know, bite us. And I'd rather the, you know, government listen to us rather than having to learn the hard way, but here we are.
Another thing that was supposed to pass at the same time that the CALEA Act was introduced was something called the Clipper chip, which was supposed to be a piece of equipment that would come in every computing device that would allow law enforcement to snoop on the communications going in and out of that device. That never passed, thankfully. But keeping in mind that at the time that was attempted to be, there was an effort into getting that passed, and thinking about cell phones that you have today, where you have two CPUs in every single phone. You have the one that's running the operating system that you interact with, and then you have another one that handles the communications with your cell provider.
Baseband, I believe, provider. Right?
I don't know the actual name of that chip.
I'm pretty sure it's the baseband chip, but I could be wrong. Yeah, I know exactly. Yeah, you're exactly right.
You can get all the information that you want about the chip that's running the operating system. You have a very hard time getting information about the other one. So the one that's running Android or that's running iOS or whatever it is that you're running talks to the one that handles communications whenever it needs to do a call or whenever it needs to receive or send messages. And everything goes through it. And it's essentially a black box at this point. And one of the major forces driving encryption being widely used, and when you have end-to-end encryption and in chat applications, then that's the big target right now to get some type of backdoor in, is precisely because you can't trust the network. And the network starts inside of your equipment. So keep that in mind whenever you're discussing security and securing your devices and the devices that you use inside of your infrastructure, because there might be stuff lurking that you're not aware of.
And this will bypass endpoint security devices if you're using a phone at work that has protection on it. I mean, this is the baseband chip. It's a backdoor. I mean, it's at such a lower level that, no matter what you're doing, I mean, you could be victim to this. It's there. And like you said, we export all these things all over the world. And, you know, the United States being so big, this causes an effect on many countries out there that didn't ask for this, and it's just so egregious on several different levels.
When you're doing end-to-end encryption on your chat application, I don't know, Telegram, whatever it is, whatever uses end-to-end encryption properly, the data packets are encrypted before they hit anything else. So it's encrypted when you press send, it's decrypted on the other side when it's received. However, we've known for a few years now, ever since Edward Snowden came out with lots of information, that data is being stored regardless of it being encrypted or not. On the off chance that at some point in the future, computing is going to be so powerful that it breaks encryption, and they're keeping data stored in the off chance that they'll be able to break it in the future. Mm-hmm. So even if you're using chat applications like that to avoid this type of snooping, that's not 100% foolproof.
This is exactly why we have to retire ciphers after some time, because at one point a cipher is so strong no computer can break it reasonably without a room full of computers, but as processors get faster, then we need a stronger cipher to replace it. So we, you know, TLS, we go from 1.1 to 1.2, and there's other examples of this, because we have to be on our toes and we have to match the security in the crypto to the capabilities of the hardware at the time. So, and just like you said, it's only a matter of time before the ciphers that we have right now are easily broken. And today it's hard, but it's not always going to be. In a backdoor,
just means, like you said, we have, you know, a threat actor has that data on their hard drive or whatever, and they're just waiting for an opportunity to get access to it and decipher it.
And this is the type of story that tinfoil wearing people really love. But when it comes to this level, and when we get information, reliable information, that this is actually being exploited in the wild, this immediately affects the enterprise environment, because you have lots of mobile devices, you have lots of computing devices, networking and all of that. So it really pays to keep an eye out on this type of things and pay attention to these stories, because you might find out that the way that this was actually implemented and abused was through equipment that you might have in your own server rack.
Mm-hmm. True story. It's also another developing story. There's going to be a lot more of this, unfortunately.
Okay, and now we have one that's been some months in the making. Mm-hmm. Remember VMware being acquired by Broadcom?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that caused the stir in the market, and we're still feeling the effects of this. And it's not just the small and medium businesses being affected by this, large companies are also affected. So one of the changes that Broadcom implemented on VMware's pricing plan is that they abolished all the lifetime and perpetual licenses that existed before. Right now, they're billing you per CPU and the socket ratio. There's this calculation that they do, and they will bill you according to that. And AT&T, which has 8,600 servers running VMware and 75,000 virtual machines running on them, they got beat pretty hard by this. So apparently VMware proposed them a 10x increase on whatever they were paying before to maintain support.
Yep.
And that's a really, really tough increase to swallow, even for AT&T. And so AT&T is suing Broadcom. So at face value, that's not immediately a security problem. Until you think about it for a sec and you realize that right now AT&T is being held ransom. And the way that it's being held ransom is that a transition to a different infrastructure, to a different hypervisor, means that it's going to take, and I'm going to be pretty generous here, at the very least 3 to 5 years to migrate these many servers and these many VMs, and doing it properly without disrupting the existing customers that they have. And they will have to pay, or they will have to stop using those services. And that becomes a security problem pretty quickly. That becomes a security problem in so many different ways. You have to deploy new systems to cover for this. You have to deploy new hypervisors. You have to train your teams to work on the new hypervisors. You have to learn the ins and outs. You have to throw away all the documentation that you have for VMware infrastructure, and you have to write new documentation for the new hypervisor that you pick. You have to work out all the kinks during the migration. It's going to be a really tough position. And on top of all of that, you need to make sure that the new systems are also secure. That's basically starting over. And starting over for these many servers, these many VMs, it's a daunting task.
Yeah, I would imagine they're going to have to at least hire additional help for a migration like this. So they're going to have that cost. I believe it was somewhere above $40 million in migration costs. So here we're going to have admins spread thin. And when admins are spread thin, then security issues can happen. And that's also a big part of it, too. It's a 1,050% price increase. That's incredible. That's just like you said, it's hard to swallow even for AT&T. And even if they can swallow it, I mean, obviously, you don't pay a company that does this to you. I mean, what's next? You say, okay, you know what, we're just going to bite the bullet and just pay them and just have to be okay with it, just to find out that there's a 1,500% price increase next year. I mean, it's really hard to trust a company after they do this. And in the article, they mention that there's a clause in the contract that allows them to sunset products to basically get themselves out of this situation. So you're buying these licenses thinking, you know, you're going to have this. In the fine print, they have the ability to say, we're not going to do that anymore. We don't really want to do that anymore. And I think at that point, even if a company, you know, begrudgingly can pay for this new license. I just don't think many will, because once you break trust and your partner, you know, you're a partner with these people, you know, it's really hard to justify continuing that partnership when, you know, as much as I hate to put it like this, I will, you know, this is a middle finger to customers.
Oh, if it is. And it's not like AT&T can pay the bill. Of course they can pay the bill. They're a multi-million dollar company. They have more than enough money to pay the bill. The problem, like you said, it's the trust. How can they trust VMware not to pull exactly the same stunt 1 year from now and then charging them another 10x increase on top of that? Because as long as they're being held ransom by this company and they're still using their products, they have to pay. They have no other alternative. They have compliance requirements to meet. They can't simply go without support. And like you said, the trick here that VMware used was that they had a perpetual license with AT&T. And like you said, there's this clause that allows VMware to sunset products. So they simply removed the perpetual licenses from the table and said that they no longer offer them. So they are no longer forced to provide support for those licenses since they no longer offer them. And that's how they got out of the contract. This will, of course, go to court, and they'll try to wrangle it out in court. But it's a really tough position to be in. And I really feel for the IT teams and the ops guys that are really going to have to fix this mess, because this business decision is going to be really tough on that.
I remember at one point some people were saying that this price increase only impacts smaller companies and there's not going to be an increase on, you know, the bigger companies, which, as we know, is absolutely not true. Even a big company, you know, a big company is not safe from this either. Nobody is. If you're using VMware, I mean, there's problems right now, and there's alternatives. And I think that the alternatives are going to be looked at very profusely. I don't think I've read what AT&T is going to move toward, but I'm very curious what eventually they end up going with. If it's going to be one of our, you know, within our network, we talk a lot about Proxmox and XCPNG. There's obviously other ones. It'd be interesting to see what direction they go to. But, you know, in the here and now, we have Broadcom doing business and, you know, by making their companies angry. I don't think that's a good business model.
Really? That's an understatement,
yeah,
I believe.
To put it lightly. Yeah, putting it lightly, absolutely. It's, and you know, I have heard that, you know, this is probably obvious, even before this story, XCPNG and Proxmox are getting like a lot more, you know, a lot more people using them now than they ever have before. I even see, you know, my Proxmox videos, the older ones, start bubbling up in my list of views, higher than normal views, and I see the, you know, news impacting the video views, and I can tell you there's a lot of eyes on Proxmox, and I'm sure on Tom Lawrence's channel he's getting a lot of hits on his XCPNG videos, rightfully so. But, you know, the information's out there for people that want to switch, but it's not that easy, because like you said, you have so many situations lately where people, IT people, are, you know, oh yeah, everything's fine, the, you know, everything's solid, and we've implemented this and that, and we're good, and then they come into work on Monday, all hands on deck, we have another migration that we have to do fresh off the recent one, and, you know, they're still reeling from probably the CentOS and Red Hat situation and CrowdStrike happening recently, and now it's like, oh yeah, let's have another situation where we have to get all our people together and lose some weekends and holidays over this. It really hurts a lot of people in different angles in different ways, and it's just, for everybody, it's a bad situation.
For most customers, apparently it's a 3x increase, so they tripled whatever they were charging before, but AT&T was a bit harder. And Mr. Hock Tan, which is Broadcom's president, he has this blog where he publishes some stuff, and in one of his articles, there's this charming gem: we will charge our customers based on the value we create for them. And when you're talking about an infrastructure solution like VMware, that's really, really something very difficult to measure. When you purchase a server, it's not more expensive if you're going to run 100 VMs on top of it than it is if you're going to run 10. You purchase a server. You're going to tell me, sure, but hardware is different than software and it's built differently. That may be true, but VMware, used as an hypervisor, it's more of an infrastructure part than an actual software part. You can disagree on that, but that's a generally accepted view. So essentially, you're going to charge more your customers. Imagine you're a water company. You're going to charge your customers more if they use it, say, to create a high-value product than if they're just filling their swimming pool. You're not entitled to know that. You're just providing water to your customers. You're not entitled to know or charge more or less based on how much your customer makes off of that water. You charge for that water whatever you want to charge, and the rest is up for your customer. And that's how it should operate. And VMware apparently is not looking at it this way. And they're trying to extract as much money as soon as possible from this. Probably because Broadcom paid $69 billion with a B to acquire VMware, and they want to recoup that money quickly.
Yeah. I mean, it's so self-righteous. It's like, so where does this end? If I spin up an Ubuntu 2404 server just for 5 minutes because I want to test a package or something, I do this all the time, and I don't think it's worth all that much. It's just a disposable VM. I don't really care about it. I'm going to delete it in 5 minutes. But then Broadcom's, well, we think you're getting a lot more value out of that VM. We're going to charge you a lot more for it. Well, excuse me? Like, do I get a say in what's important to my business and what assets are the most critical to my network? Or are they just going to decide that they think it's important, so they charge based on that? And it's their opinion against their users. It's incredible.
At the very least, it's a very tricky business decision that Broadcom made. Software licensing costs have always been this magical thing that companies dream up. It's really tricky to position it. It's really tricky to come up with a number that's reasonable and cost-effective and your customers are willing to pay. So there is some leeway whenever you're trying to get a deal with your providers when you're trying to acquire licenses for software. But again, framing it like this, that we're going to extract as much money as the value that you're creating from it, that's, I'm pretty sure there are laws against that.
I would have to say so, because it's an artificial supply and demand. I mean, it's like you have a company, you have a demand on your supply, but you're going to increase that demand just because you want more money for no other reason. It's not like we're getting an incredible feature set coming to VMware that it's never had before that transforms the way that people spin up VMs. No, it's VMware. If you've used VMware before, it's the same now. I'm not aware of any, you know, value add of any kind other than, you know, value add to Broadcom, basically. It's just, it's like they're getting an incredible value out of that. But what are we getting for a 1,050% increase? I mean, every purchasing department I have ever talked to at any company would probably have the exact same questions. Okay, you're increasing the price. What do we get out of this? What is this going to do for our business? Is this going to help us do business better? Are we going to be more profitable if we continue with you? No, we're just going to be allowed to continue using the software we've already been using. And to call it anything less than ransom, we're having the wrong conversation.
They're abusing their position. We've had trials before go exactly about this. You cannot abuse your dominant position on the market. And that's exactly what they're doing. When you're pricing your products based on the value that you're bringing to the market, that's one thing. When you're pricing your products based on the value that your customers are getting out of it, that's something else. You either include that in the base price and then that's for everybody, or you don't do prices a la carte for every single customer depending on how much they're extracting from it. First, you'll never have a correct metric of that. Mm-hmm. And second, again, you're abusing your dominant position. There have been trials about this in the past, and that's never seen positively. Even in a free market country like the US, they really dislike this type of things when it reaches courts.
Well, immediately I could think of the price-fixing lawsuits with ebooks, and that was a much smaller problem. I mean, just with the price-fixing thing, that got legal attention. I mean, I would think this would, all it takes is the right lawyer with the right knowledge of how things are and what's allowed. And sure, there's things in the contract that give them, you know, ability to come out of it, but it could still go to court, a precedent can still be set. And this could backfire, and I hope it does, on Broadcom in glorious ways. They think that their contract's going to save them, and maybe it could. But at the same time, you know, there's very smart lawyers out there, and there's precedents set in the past where, you know, artificial supply and demand. I mean, we're literally paying for someone's yacht and personal jet at this point.
Until they get the $69 billion back, they're not going to go back down from this. the firm Gartner that does research into market studies and all of those kinds of things, they did a study recently about the changes in pricing from VMware. And this is where this touches back on the first story. They found that some people are doing something called revirtualization, which is a term that they used for moving to a different platform. And apparently it's about 20% of VMware customers are looking into alternative solutions right now. And there are others that are going devirtualization, which is a really bad word, but means going back to metal, which means that they're looking at workloads and they're seeing the ones that don't really benefit from being virtualized and they're moving them back to actual physical servers. That kills consolidation, which is something that we've been striving to as an industry in the past 20, 25 years now. But they just need to weigh the pros and cons here. Are they paying more to get that service done in a way that fits a virtual machine versus just running it bare metal? And if they're paying more to keep it in a virtual machine, then they'll probably move to a physical server. That's how ridiculous this whole situation gets. And there are companies looking at doing that.
And then you think about greenhouse gases increasing because now we're using more physical hardware than we were using before when everything was trending one direction. Now it's trending back. I mean, there's a lot of repercussions to this. And then the mental health aspect of all the people that just can't seem to get a vacation day lately because they just can't seem to slow down on the controversy. And it's, I mean, I really just wish there was an easy way to migrate, but when you have like tens of thousands of virtual machines, that's a workload, and it doesn't matter how good your automation system is at this point. Yeah, you might have something amazing that automates migrations and things, but you have to check everything. You have to test everything. You can't just spin it up and just assume it's good any more than anyone else can. That's a lot of work. I mean, having to audit all these VMs after migration, making sure that the TCP connections are able to be handled, because if you think about this, there's user testing, user load testing that people do, and rightfully so, where they try to find out how many users they can have on a server before it starts to struggle. And on one platform, there could be like TCP/IP tuning that's just slightly different enough, and now they have to have more servers to handle the same number of TCP connections. And now they're going to have more, you know, they have tens of thousands of servers. Now they have to add a few thousand more. I mean, this is how they do it. I mean, development teams, they test it. They see what does it take to, you know, can we hit this server with 10,000 users, 20,000 users? What can we get away with? And they have to tune these things and test these things. So I feel like the migration is tough, but it's just the beginning. That's just getting your stuff to the eventual replacement. Once it's there, You have to look at this, and that's going to take an incredible amount of time to facilitate a migration like this.
And to do it securely, it's going to take even longer. Whether you move to Proxmox, to XCPNG, to OpenNebula, to any of the other virtualization solutions, pray tell you move to Hyper-V. Regardless of what you move to, it's a new stack that you need to learn. It's a new technology that you need to understand. It's a new thing that you need to keep secure. It's something that you're not used to, that you need to learn the ins and outs so that when a patch drops, you're not going to get cornered into a new bug that you're not aware of, and you need to know how to react to that. That's why VMware's position, they're essentially holding everything. They have everybody hostage at this point. Doing the migration takes years. Companies are not too keen on doing that for all the reasons that we mentioned. That's why they're trying to extort as much money as possible from these deals. But this is not going to buy them any favors. This is not going to get them any new customers. And eventually this is going to hurt them.
Right.
This is also another reflex of what's happening in the industry, where stuff that doesn't need to be a subscription is moving to subscription-based, regardless of this is being targeted to end users or to other companies, to business or business to consumer. It doesn't really matter. Stuff that doesn't have to be a subscription and has never been a subscription is now turning into one. When you had perpetual licenses for VMware, you didn't want to worry yourself about paying subscriptions every year and changing terms and all of that. That's why you acquired the most expensive license at the time. And now that's off the table, and that's a worrying trend. There's stuff that needs to be a subscription because it's a recurring service and you actually get value from it being a subscription. And then there are other stuff that is just being artificially transformed into one, and you get absolutely nothing out of it other than an expensive bill to pay.
So we can't trust our cloud providers to have logs. We can't have private conversations on phones, and we can't trust hypervisor providers either. Yeah, this is a lot of stuff here that we have to keep in mind. And the trust factor is extremely important, as we say a lot. I mean, it's not just trusting your users. We have to trust our systems. We have to trust our vendors to have our back. And, you know, giving the middle finger to the people and the companies that, you know, made VMware able to be acquired for such a high amount of money in the first place, they're snubbing their nose at them too. It's just, I just really want to know what Broadcom's end game is here. Are they just trying to destroy VMware? Are they trying to make nobody use it? I mean, I can't think of anything else.
It's unfathomable at this point. Nobody really understands it outside of Broadcom's CEO, apparently.
Yeah, probably just wanted a yacht and that was all it was. Who knows?
Yeah. But the one thing that you can trust is that you're going to get episode 101 of this podcast coming soon. Can't really promise that it's going to be next week and then we break the promise, but we will be back for the next one. Thank you very much for sticking with us for the previous 100 episodes, and we're going to be here for the next 100. So come by for the next one. We'll be right here. Thank you very much to everybody who joined. As always, a pleasure.
Thank you, guys.